Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
It's a disaster. It's a disaster. The river started flowing over the highway, which flowed into our yards, my neighbor's yard, my yard. Our houses are full of water.
That's Karen Corshane speaking about her home on Peguis First Nation land in Manitoba and the flood that struck her community 2 years ago this month.
It's devastating. It's a loss, right? Oh, it's just a very difficult time, stressful time.
Some of the people who were forced to flee Peguis in 2022, including Karen, are still displaced. I'm going to be speaking to the federal minister responsible about whether that is acceptable a little later on in the show, because this is a familiar and ongoing story. Indigenous communities are disproportionately affected by climate-related disasters, and there are so many things that can add to the stress of having to leave home.
When an evacuation happens, often it's people you don't know. They knock on your door, you're grabbed from your home, you're put on a bus, then you're driving for a long time, you're put in some institutional setting, like a congregate setting, like a gym, with lines and lines of cots. The bright lights are on all the time. So for residential school survivors, it's a traumatic triggering event. There is a lot there that needs to be changed to make it much more culturally safe.
That's disaster planning expert Lily Yumagulova, and I'm Laura Lynch, and this is What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. Today, solutions that can help Indigenous communities better prepare for and respond to disasters. So all of that stress that you just heard about, Joseph Sayers can relate to it. He works for the Missinabe Cree First Nation as the general manager for their business corporation. And that corporation owns a company called ISN Maskwa. It's trying to do evacuations differently with a unique approach that puts First Nations in control.
We try to plan culturally appropriate means of supporting evacuations for First Nations. I think the goal for the community of Missinabe Cree is to support their sister First Nations, other Indigenous people that, you know, have been evacuated for years. Much like Peguis, there are communities in Ontario that face the threat of floods on an annual basis.
And one of those is the Kasechewan First Nation near James Bay. Like the Peguis, they live on a floodplain. An evacuation is an annual stress. But Joseph wants to change the way emergencies are handled across the country. The company is even building its own center to host evacuees. Joseph Sayers, what's behind the approach that you take to evacuations?
We quickly learned that the current system where, you know, First Nation people were taken out of their home communities into large urban settings, you know, by non-Indigenous service providers. And, you know, we're essentially either in aggregate settings or in hotel rooms, you know, with very little freedom of movement outside of that. And, you know, for years, chiefs of those communities have been expressing their concerns that, you know, their folks unfortunately sometimes fall victim to a lot of the social ills in those municipalities, whether it's human trafficking or drug traffickers, or just simply, you know, being able to safely move about the city. So with an Indigenous-led approach, with trained Indigenous community support personnel, we're able to work with communities like Kasechewan. We've trained Kasechewan members, for instance, in how to help us understand the logistics to get people out of the community safely. We've been able to secure sites. We've been able to engage with air charters, ground transportations, accommodations, food services, health services, mental health services, cultural activities and support programs, so that when they come out of those communities, they feel like they're in a position of control over the situation. We try to head off any potential situations whether it's, you know, community safety, our health situations. And again, it's the community itself that we've developed the capacity within to be able to manage a lot of that themselves with our mentoring and leadership. So it's definitely a different approach. You know, we've demonstrated, I think, that an Indigenous-led approach is not only safer for the folks, but also has reduced impacts on the health support systems and the social support systems within those communities.
I just want to ask you a bit more about one thing that you mentioned, is that members of the First Nations who've had to flee being exposed to what you called social ills. Mm-hmm. What are you talking about, and how do you deal with that?
Well, in the past, and this has been brought forward, you know, by many chiefs over the last couple decades, when folks are brought into, say, Mississauga or Windsor or Thunder Bay or even smaller towns, human traffickers, drug traffickers know or find out or figure out that, you know, these folks from the remote communities are here at this hotel or that particular hotel, and they're often victimized by those influences. And on occasion in the past, people, when they're ready to be repatriated back to the community, they're not to be found. And in some instances, they're found maybe homeless or on the streets, or maybe sometimes they're just not found, period. So that's been a longstanding concern amongst the leadership of the northern communities.
How do you handle that?
Well, we have, we have a trained First Nation men and women from all across the province. We trained and hired over 300 First Nation men and women to provide security. They are licensed under the security guard regulations in Ontario, but we've added additional skill sets, whether it's first aid or mental health first aid or crisis intervention skills. So they work with the people. If there's an activity, say they want to go to the mall, then we have security attend with them. We have check-in points. So we have found ways to keep them engaged, keep them, you know, doing healthy, you know, fun things as well for the kids, for the youth themselves, as well as elders and adults, you know, just by, you know, thinking ahead and working with local agencies. The Mushkegawa Tribal Council in particular has been fantastic. Their health unit, mental health unit's been attending and staying in some of the communities as well, providing not only counseling services, but also creating culturally appropriate activities for the folks to engage with.
Does one particular event come to mind for you?
Well, I hate to say it, but bingo. prize bingo, you know, that's a lot of fun. It keeps people entertained. We had some previous or other evacuations we had around the time of the goose hunt, which is now. You know, bring in fresh goose, so the community gets together and prepares those, you know, for a feast. We've had fish donated from the indigenous fisheries on Lake Superior. So we had fish fry, so people can come out to that and, socialize and have fun over a meal. And then there are other sports activities, recreational activities, whether it's, you know, inside of a gymnasium. I know that the city of Barrie with the Bannock Health Center has also created an incredible program of different activities for all ages. So it's really, it's fantastic. You know, I reflect a little bit on, you know, not just the emergency preparation and response and, you know, safety of the folks, but sometimes we don't factor in what this means to the host community. And it varies. You know, there are situations in smaller towns that, in terms of the culture, that, you know, aren't as readily embraced as other municipalities. But what I find is, as you know, this is really a like kind of reconciliation in a microcosm, and people are kind of, you know, finding their feet in terms of how to relate to Indigenous people where there's a really significant cultural barrier here in, you know, 2024, because these folks come from a remote community that isn't necessarily connected right to how life is in the city of Barrie, for instance. So I think it's a real cross-cultural exchange that's happening, you know, as we speak. And it's really positive. And I think it's a building of community and breaking down some of those barriers.
So you've been pretty intimately involved in all of this. And I'm wondering if you have examples of people who have been forced to leave, whether they've told you about other stressful, traumatic evacuations, and then what kind of difference it makes to have other Indigenous people involved in those evacuations as community support personnel or CSPs?
Well, quite a few of our CSPs are from communities and have been evacuees themselves. So they know what it's like to be uprooted their entire family for sometimes weeks
and what have they told you?
It's like night and day. First off, you know, they've shared concerns that they recall being put in hotels under lock and key, not allowed to leave the rooms. And, you know, for folks, any human being, I think, under those circumstances, especially young people, are going to push back against that. So then it creates situations where people, you know, leave unattended, you know, maybe get into trouble. So having, and now that they're CSBs or incident command trainees, they know that end of the experience, and they're bringing that into their role for us. So they know how to address those concerns. You know, if they know when the stress levels amongst the evacuees and families are reaching a boiling point, that they can go in and de-escalate and de-conflict those situations because they had that their own personal experience being an evacuee themselves.
And I think of older people and what we heard referenced earlier who might find it very triggering because of their residential school experience. Have you talked to any of them?
Well, our very first deployment was a few years ago. And we were brought in because the situation was very tense between the community at the time, the Quebec Sûreté, who was providing the security. And it's a bit of a military institutional setting. So I think that contributed to the tension. And by us, you know, sending in our Indigenous-led team, we're able to deconflict and build trust with the community on the one hand, and then work and talk on a professional level with the police force and the managers there. And we're able to turn around that situation, which could have become very problematic for not only evacuees, but for the host, and made that work. So I think you're right. You know, there are triggering elements to just the facility itself, and maybe having uniform folks with badges, riot gear, whatever they wear, is also intimidating and triggering to Indigenous folks. So our CSPs are not in uniforms. They're in ball caps that say ISM Masqua or T-shirts or golf shirts that, you know, they're readily identifiable, but they're not threatening.
But during evacuations, there are sometimes people who don't want to leave. They don't want to be sent away. They want to go out on their trap lines to wait out an emergency. And the federal government has recently started supporting it thanks to First Nations advocacy. Do you know anyone doing this?
K'sechuan. There's over 1,000 that went out on the land. We support them as well, and they're supported by Indigenous Services Canada.
Why do they want to do that, though? Why the preference for staying out on their trap lines or on their land?
Well, I think it's probably the connection to the land. I mean, as Indigenous people, that's really our primary relationship, and that's been their lifestyle. And again, this is the springtime, so the goose hunt is a very major cultural, community-oriented activity. So I imagine people would want to continue to do that and not be stuck in a hotel room somewhere. And if they have the option to go on the trap line or their camps, they just prefer to be out on the land. And that's probably the safest out of all the options, I think, barring any kind of medical condition. It's First Nation led. If the First Nation feels that they're better off out on the land, folks like Indigenous Services, ourselves, need to support that. And make sure that they're safe and they're supported. And we do wellness checks on a daily basis through helicopters and visits and bringing them supplies. And there are folks that are still in the community. So we do have CSP members that are, you know, making wellness checks and visiting them on a daily basis. And people also have pets, you know, good old res dogs. They still need to be fed. And we provide that service with the support of the federal government as well.
Listening to everything that you're doing, I'm just wondering, how unique is what you do? Are you the first of your kind?
I think Missinaba Crees has a reputation to be the first on many fronts. And emergency management is probably the kind of the gem in all their accomplishments. So this is the first Indigenous-owned emergency evacuation center of its kind, at least in the country, that's on Indigenous reserve lands. With ISM Masqua, that's probably one of the only companies of its kind with that full wraparound service. And with the support of the federal government, we've also instituted what we call an Indigenous Emergency Operational Center based in the Sioux. So we have a small staff at present with a 24-hour duty officer to receive any kind of emergency calls. And we're looking at growing that out in the next 3 to 5 years to include more Indigenous communities. So ultimately, even though it's founded and spearheaded and championed by Missinaba, we'll be sitting at the table with all those impacted communities on the operational side ultimately.
So we'll be speaking to Indigenous Services Canada Minister Patty Haidu after you. I'm wondering, what do you say to the question of what more Ottawa needs to do when it comes to making emergency response more culturally safe for Indigenous communities?
Well, first, I'd say Chi-Migwich, Patty, for your organization's support for First Nation-led emergency management across the province and ultimately across the country, and having faith in our community to be able to manage this and kind of execute. But I think the one thing I would ask or recommend is work with us to bring this to the other regions of the country, like the Peguis communities of the country and beyond, because we think we're, and I think she understands this, we're onto something, I think, meaningful in a lot of ways, and we're more than happy to share our model and experience with other regions and other First Nations.
But what's standing in the way of that happening?
Well, time is part of it. I mean, we're in a climate crisis, right? And even though we're doing so much and we've trained so many, we still feel that there's so much more work and more capacity that has to be developed in Ontario as well as other regions. And, you know, as the climate warms up, you know, here in Ontario, we've barely seen any snow, which in my backyard, my neck of the woods, is just unprecedented. And we're looking at an incredibly volatile fire season in the coming months. So I think time is our mutual enemy here. So we really need to get to work. And for her counterparts, not just Indigenous Services, but I think public security or provincial emergency management operations in Ontario and across the board, really have to roll up the sleeves and let's all work together to be able to respond to the crises that we're all facing.
Joseph Sayers, thank you.
All right, miigwech.
Paper or plastic?
Oh, I forgot my own bags. Plastic. No, wait, paper. Hang on, which one's better? I don't know.
Don't stress, Neil. The podcast Living Planet is here to help. We know you want to do what's right for the planet, but you're busy and you have to make 1,000 small decisions every day. So we endeavor to answer, what's better?
Cotton or polyester?
Tea or coffee?
For answers to these environmental conundrums and your questions, subscribe to Living Planet wherever you listen to podcasts.
So Joseph Sayers' company is working to make emergency response more appropriate and safer for people living in Indigenous communities. But is Ottawa doing enough to support this work across the country? Patty Haidu is the Minister for Indigenous Services Canada. Minister Haidu, hello.
Hello, great to be here.
So Joseph Sayers says he needs the government to roll up its sleeves and work together with First Nations to prepare for another wildfire season. I'm wondering what you've learned from the approach the ISN Maskwa Indigenous-owned company is taking.
Well, I think, I think that we are all facing unprecedented crisis related to climate change. And I would say that First Nations peoples are the first on the line, the front line of climate change. They're often in communities that are remote, surrounded by forests or in floodplains, and are feeling the effects of climate change in very profound ways. So I would agree with Joseph that we need to do more, and we need to do more quickly together and prevent, to the degree that we can, some of these disasters from becoming the size that they are becoming.
Now, we've heard from Indigenous leaders across Canada that emergency evacuations are safer when they are overseen by Indigenous people. I mean, besides the project that Joseph Sayers told us about, how else are you supporting that kind of work?
Well, we have really transitioned the way that emergency management is being handled by the federal government, which is really what it was before, by the federal government for First Nations. Generally speaking, you know, the government of Canada would pay after a disaster, for example, after the bills have come due, which really tied communities' hands who were didn't have the fiscal capacity to be able to manage that financially or were really worried about what kinds of expenses would be covered or not. It really came to my attention meeting with the Chilcotin. In fact, the government of Canada and the Chilcotin were at odds over, you know, millions of dollars that the Chilcotin had spent to save their community infrastructure and to save lives. And the whole community had done an amazing job and actually lost very little, if any, infrastructure. And now, you know, when I met the Chilcotin, their ask was for Indigenous Services Canada to stop fighting about some of the expenses they had incurred. And I asked the question, you know, what kinds of expenses are in dispute? But when Chilcote and talked about, you know, supporting their volunteers who are working 24 hours a day, many other expenses related to keeping morale high amongst those volunteers that were, you know, in literal Hades with flames all around them. It became very clear to me that we needed to change and adjust.
Right. But I guess you're talking about post-disaster or in the midst of disaster. I think what Joseph Sayers is trying to do is not only to deal with evacuations during, but preparation. And Canada's Auditor General Karen Hogan put out a report in November of 2022 that said Indigenous Services Canada was failing to provide the support First Nations need to deal with emergencies. They said it was government spending 3.5 times more money on response and recovery after disasters than it was on helping communities prepare for disasters. And your government agreed with that assessment. So since then, how much more money has the government put towards First Nations disaster preparedness?
In budget 2024, there's, you know, additional money available for the kinds of work that we've been doing with First Nations. And I just want to go back to the Chilcotin because I actually disagree with you. I think that, you know, that example was something that I think really stimulated me to push the department to reorient how we actually work for First Nations to prepare and to respond, because those things are not actually disconnected. And so budget 2024 does invest another $166 million to support that preparedness, the training that ISN Moskwa is doing and others, but also to make sure that communities have emergency management coordinators that come from their communities. So these
are not still emergency. Though, even that number you just quoted still doesn't bring it up to nearly the amount that is being spent on response and recovery.
No, and I think we have to realize there's going to be two tracks for a while. You're going to have, you know, the amounts of money spent on crisis because crisis continue, you know, regardless of the investments you make on the preparedness piece. And they're very, very expensive.
I just want to ask.
So it's two things at once.
One of the specific recommendations from the Auditor General was related to paying for more emergency management coordinators, paid positions for people living in First Nations communities. What progress have you made on that?
So there are paid coordinators now increasingly in First Nations. And in fact, First Nations are in the process of hiring more. There's 248 now. There's one in each 48 First Nations in Alberta, for example. In budget 2024, part of that investment is exactly that. It's to ensure that every First Nation has the position of a paid coordinator so that people aren't doing this off the side of their desk, which is hard to believe that that was the expectation. Yeah. That is for sure something that needs the full focus of an individual.
I just want to turn to the Peguis First Nation now, because it flooded 2 years ago this month, and the chief of that nation says there are still around 550 people who have been unable to return home. And let's listen to Karen Corshane. She's one of the people who was forced to leave 2 years ago, and she is still living in Winnipeg.
I thought it was temporary. I'm going to be in Winnipeg for a short amount of time, and I'm going to make my way back home. But the longer it gets, the more I'm starting to think it's not temporary and this may well be a permanent move. I would rather be in my own home, in the community. I'm a visitor in Peguis now. I'm not a resident anymore. I'm a visitor. It makes me feel disconnected. It's like, and you don't have your roots anymore.
2 years out of her home, Minister, are you satisfied with the way your government has handled that disaster?
Well, listen, I think that no one should be out of their home for 2 years. And having experienced flooding in my own life and being dislocated for far shorter, I can tell you any period of dislocation is extremely disorienting. And 2 years must feel hopeless, as you can hear in the voice of the person that you spoke with. But what I can tell you is that we've worked with Peguis leadership. I've signed an agreement in principle to move as quickly as the community wants to in terms of rebuilding. And the challenge is that Peguis continues to flood. So just as, you know, new homes are built or infrastructure is built, oftentimes that very same infrastructure is at risk of flooding. And so Peguis has, you know, got some new leadership right now. I'm really looking forward to working with the community to determine how best to resolve these ongoing challenges
It looks like one of the ways that Peguis is trying to resolve it is by suing the government for $1 billion for damages caused by that flood. And it alleges a breach of duty of care and negligence in failing to prevent or remedy the 2022 flood. I mean, you've talked about the chronic problems there. What is your response to the allegations?
Well, I'd say that Peguis is in the situation that many other First Nations are, in that they were intentionally put there by colonial governments, both provincial and federal, and then sort of, you know, at the mercy of the, I would say, disadvantaged land that oftentimes First Nations were provided as a process
but,
of
but
the
that,
settlement
that's
of this
history.
Country.
That's history. But, they're saying you breached your duty of care. You are negligent.
Well, I would say that, look, obviously, a flooding situation like that is, it feels to me like there is an ongoing risk to Peguis for flooding, given the location of their land. And that's part of the agreement in principle to discuss how we support Peguis and self-determination about what their next steps are. So I'm always interested in working with communities that want to find those kinds of solutions, including the ongoing infrastructure work that needs to happen in Peguis.
Yeah, and as you said, I am going to go back to history now because they were forcibly displaced onto the land they currently live on in 1907. Repeated floods. I just want you to listen to Karen Koshin again.
I have no faith in the Canadian government. You know, they've done us wrong since 1907. You know, why are they going to do it right now? And that's why I'm really grateful for the leadership who are litigating. That's the only way Canada listens. You know, you have to take them to court. And what are they going to do? Canada's going to fight us all the way. They'll spend $1 billion to not fulfill those obligations because that's what they do. That's Canada's story, you know.
Minister, what do you want to say to Karen Koshin?
Oh, you know, listen, Karen's not wrong about the colonial approach that the government of Canada has had to Indigenous peoples. I mean, look at the history books and are replete with stories of the ways that Indigenous people have been harmed by colonial practices and policies. And so I hear the frustration and the exhaustion in her voice. And I would just say that this federal government under the leadership of Justin Trudeau has put reconciliation in the forefront. And so what I always say is that we need to keep working with First Nations peoples to determine the tools that will help us move more quickly towards a space where people feel like their lives are valuable too. These are the kinds of things that our country has to grapple with. And so, as I said, I'm willing to roll up my sleeves and meet with administration of Peguis and find out what we can do more quickly together.
It sounds like something that could resolve it would be a big fat check from Ottawa. Are you willing to write that for them?
Well, I mean, listen, we can write a check for $1 billion, I suppose, tomorrow. But I think what Peguis wants is solutions. And so what we want to do is work with Peguis leadership on the practical solutions that are going to result in stable infrastructure that gets homes built that are not at risk of flooding again. You know, the community will have a role, too, in planning what that looks like. And the federal government has a role to help support the financing of that.
Minister Patty Haidu, thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
That's all for us. The show was put together by Andy Mullins, Jake Costello, Danielle Piper, Vivian Luck, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Matthias Wolfson, and Catherine Rolfson. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.